Welcome to the Focus Today podcast with Perry Atkinson.
Well, welcome to Focus Today. I'm your host, Perry Atkinson, and I'm delighted and honored to have back with us today Lord Conrad Black. He's the former owner of The Telegraph there in England, the Jerusalem Post in Israel, the National Post in Canada, and among other newspapers worldwide. He's a historian and a biographer and a columnist, best-selling author. And we're here to talk to him today about something that's very interesting. His latest project is called The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. And there's a picture of that on the screen, an amazing resource. You may want to pick this up. The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. Lord Conrad Black, good to see you again. How are you, friend?
I'm fine, thanks, Barry. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for your time. Why did you take on the world?
Well, you know, I've read a fair bit of history, and I started with biographies, including three of your presidents. And then I wrote what I call the strategic history of the United States. Obviously, the history of the United States is a vast literature, and I had nothing to add to that. But looking at how it developed strategically, I thought what had not been done. And I also wrote a history of Canada because that's an under-focused on subject in Canada. But at that point, I thought, I'm getting a bit older. What do I want to do as a sort of main work, you know, a magnum opus? And I came to the conclusion that if you follow the format I did in the book I wrote about the history of the United States, and to just explain the political development of it, now obviously cultural and economic factors come into it, but it's basically a political history, going back as far as we can authenticate history to when there were clans and tribes, how they organized and how they dealt with each other and brought it forward. It could be done in manageable length, and it could be tolerably interesting if you put it in the personalities. Now, this is not the great man theory of history, but the fact is people make history. It doesn't make itself. Mm-hmm. And so what I do is I present what people did, starting in ancient Mesopotamia, ancient India, and ancient China. And the volume you mentioned there brings us up to the beginning of the Christian era and the death of the first Roman Emperor Augustus, Julius. I'm 3/4 of the way through Volume 2, which will bring us up almost to the American Revolution. And the last volume will bring us the rest of the way. And they are big books, but they're divided carefully into chapters and the chapters into sections. So you can start anywhere, start again 6 months later, go from back to front or front to back or whatever you want. It's all there. And it is, of course, it's 3,000 pages. But, you know, behind me are the traditional ancient history of the Cambridge University and Oxford University's history of England. Prior to this, if you really wanted to look at the history of the world, you'd have to read 800-page volumes. Now you don't have to do that anymore.
Wow. Amazing. That's a lot of work.
A lot of work.
What are you seeing? What's jumping out at you?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
What are you seeing in this first volume? What's jumping out at you that you didn't know?
There is progress. If you start in Volume 1, which is Mesopotamia, and particularly the Jews, up to David and Solomon, and the second, the very last chapter is just a very brief conclusion. So go to the second last chapter, 29. You see an enormous development in human organization. In ancient Mesopotamia, they were essentially tribes constantly at war with each other, though some of the personalities, and especially the Jewish figures, were noteworthy. And of course, the Jews were particularly trend-setting because they were monotheistic. But in the volume on the organization of the Roman Empire under Augustus, you see you could go from what is today Lisbon to Baghdad. On good Roman roads with hostels at points along the way, You have no fear of being robbed or attacked or interrupted or having to pay taxes or talk to annoying immigration officials or anything like that. All around the Mediterranean, over 50 million people, and it was a common market that worked, and people from all of that part of Europe and North Africa and the Middle East were members of the Roman Senate, and there was an element of popular government, a somewhat rudimentary but active legal system, and it was a relatively advanced society. Now, that is progress, and the progress will continue. It's interrupted. It's obviously not a straight line of progress, mm-hmm. but we must not ever lose faith in the fact that we are getting smarter and better at what we do, meaning organizing society for ourselves. There are lots of setbacks and disappointments, but progress exists and it's real.
Okay, two other elements that pop out on this. In your research up to this point, was there a religious element in all this that stood out?
Second point I was going to make. From the very beginning and all the way through this volume and all the way through the next volumes, it is clear that from the beginning and throughout, there is a psychological element within practically every person who wonders about and seeks some sort of belief in matters beyond what's visible and tangible to us in terrestrial life. And initially, it took extremely primitive forms, and you could go in the Middle East between what we would today call a town of a few thousand people, they then called a city, go 20 miles away, and they would have a different set of gods. But they all had a concept of a supernatural intelligence that could be propitiated. And there was constantly a structure at which the summit were a secular leader and a high priest or ecclesiastical leader. Often there were attempts to combine them, sometimes successful, sometimes not. But that religious element has always been there. Now, when we get farther along, we will encounter the atheist. But that is in itself something that requires, in my opinion, a greater act of faith than religious belief. You actually convince yourself that there is absolutely nothing beyond what we see. Spiritual forces don't exist. All religious theories are rubbish. It takes an immense act of faith, which I personally think is mistaken faith, but it takes an immense act of faith to believe that. But my point is, in answer to your question, and I'm sorry to filibuster you, but yes, that religious element is always there. It has always been there.
I want to come to atheism a little bit later on, but right now, let me ask you this. In these beginning stages of this, where did the Bible begin to play into society?
Well, I want to make sure I understand your question. If you mean, at what point do we accept the Bible as history?
Well, yes.
In the Old Testament, there's a combination of folklore and legitimate history, and it is terribly difficult to know exactly where that demarcation is and how much of the folklore is based in fact. But my tentative conclusion was that almost all the folklore has some basis in fact. For example, on the issue of the Jews leaving Egypt by a parting of the waters, there is meteorological evidence that the water in the north end of the Red Sea that water level was lower than usual. So it is conceivable that they waded across part of it, just on what we can establish now. So I go as far back as we can be confident that it actually happened. And in many cases, I state the biblical, the Old Testament references. And occasionally I feel it necessary to point out that this must be read with caution, but this is the tradition. As for the New Testament, most of that is essentially history. Now, again, some of it his eyewitness accounts of things, or reconstitutions of them by the apostles several centuries later. I put it in there where there needs to be a qualification.
Okay.
I put it.
The book is entitled, the project entitled, The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1, and he's working on other volumes. There's a picture of the cover of the book by Lord Conrad Black. All right, Lord Black, I want to come back to just a couple simple questions. One is, I'm wondering why history is such a threat to so many people.
Because it contradicts the ideology or mythos that they are themselves propagating. The more ingenious of those people, such as the founders of the United States, for example, adapt history, take it and either present themselves as a logical continuation of an existing trend, or in any case, establish their intellectual legitimacy by anchoring themselves in some way in history. The more revolutionary people can't do that because there is no precedent for what they're doing. So they then become iconoclasts, if I may take a religious word, and say, well, we're throwing away all that rubbish. I mean, this is the Marxist line. We're creating a new man. We will perfect man. Well, of course, once you get into that sort of thing, you are banishing any respect for spiritual or supernatural or deist forces, and you are creating a vacancy that is apt ultimately to be filled by very dangerous people.
The other question I want to establish before we move on is something I asked you the last time that we got together, and it happens to fit here, and you've already commented on it, and that is the threat of atheism. Explain that.
I don't get into that in this book.
Yeah.
The book we're talking about here, by the way, the personalities on the cover, you've been kind enough to put the cover up, are from left to right, Moses, Socrates, Alexander the Great, and Julius Caesar.
Okay.
My view of atheism, and I have commented on this elsewhere,
right,
is I think it is a terribly dangerous threat. Now, let me be clear. Those people who simply do not believe in anything religiously, that's their perfect right, and I don't criticize them at all. I mean, indeed, at one time held that view myself. Nothing wrong with that. But atheism in the sense of anti-theism, militancy and intolerance against the concept of the existence of spiritual forces and the likely existence of a divine or supernatural intelligence, in my opinion, is extremely dangerous. It's not only an argument that can be defeated logically, because I think it's quite clear that mm-hmm. spiritual forces and unexplained phenomena do exist, and they can't simply be cracked up to that vast area of knowledge we haven't got to yet. I mean, this idea that there's a finite amount of knowledge, every day man knows more, and we're approaching a plenitude of knowledge, and eventually we'll know everything, is, I think, rubbish, because with each discovery, we discover that we have even farther to go. But apart from that, the danger of it is, if you take that position, you create a vacancy that man is going to fill himself.
Right.
And sometimes it's relatively benign. It's just a very powerful person who has objectively constructive goals. But we're as often or as likely to get a very dangerous person disguising and celebrating what he's doing in vast pagan festivals like the Nazi rallies at Nuremberg or Stalin's May Day parades with these colossal floats and exhibits coming through on wheels, interspersed with massive demonstrations of military power. This is a substitute for a spectacle celebrating Providence or the Almighty, and it is extremely dangerous. And once we get into that, Once we get the brilliant idea that we can perfect ourselves and modify the nature of others, we are essentially embarking on a suicide pact.
All right, let me take a break here. I could talk to you for hours. Lord Conrad Black is with us, formerly a member there of the House of Lords. He's written so many books, but his latest project is called The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. He is working on other volumes. I think you'll find this to be a fascinating resource. Let us take a quick break. We'll be right back.
We'll be back to this week's interview in just a few seconds. In the meantime, we want to let you know that you can watch this interview, plus many more exclusive interviews that happen this week on the Dove's Daily TV and radio show by visiting our website, thedove.us. And while you're there, sign up for our free daily devotional, The Word for You Today. 3 months of daily readings that will connect you with God's Word. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back, and such an honor to have back with us today Lord Conrad Black. He's a former owner of the Telegraph there in England, the Jerusalem Post in Israel, and the National Post in Canada, among other newspapers worldwide. He's a historian, a biographer, a columnist, best-selling author. He's written comprehensive histories of both Canada and the United States, certain about some of our presidents, past presidents, Franklin Roosevelt, Richard Nixon, Donald Trump. He's a dual citizen of Canada and the U.K., he's been a member of the British House of Lords, and his recent project is called The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. And there's a cover of the book on the screen there by Conrad Black. Check that out online. Lord Black, I want to ask you a couple more questions on the subject, and then we'll jump over to some current events. But as you were researching this, and trying to find the balance of what you're discovering in your research versus maybe what you were taught earlier in your young life going through school, how did you handle when you discovered those who tried to revise history?
If it was an important point, I mean, I have my differences with, for example, Edward Gibbon, the famous historian who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. When I got to things like that, I carefully put out the argument of the person I disagreed with fairly, not in a disparaging way, and then explained why I disagreed with it. Gibbon was one of those. He was personally an atheist, an 18th century writer, and a great researcher and a very florid and interesting writer. Not economical of words, certainly, but very graphic, and he held that the Christians were substantially responsible for the fall of the Roman Empire. And my theory, which I explain at length, appropriate length, not I hope tiresome length, was quite the reverse. That if Rome had adopted Christianity more quickly and completely, it would have been a powerful motivation defending the Roman Christian Empire against the barbarians. And that did operate in the Eastern Roman Empire at Constantinople, as it was called, now Istanbul, but set up by the Emperor Constantine, which continued on for 1,000 years after the Western Roman Empire. And part of that reason was it was a Christian empire, and it fiercely resisted both the barbarians in the north and the militant Islamists after the 7th century in the south and east. So that's an example of it. But
yeah.
But what I do, I certainly put out the views I'm disagreeing with fairly, and then explain why I disagree with them.
Such is the case with Julius Caesar.
I'm rather an admirer of his on balance. I think he has been misrepresented even by Shakespeare as a tyrant. He was not a tyrant, in my opinion.
Okay. All right. I only have you for a little time. I want to get you back. This is so fascinating. I want you to kind of, if you can, run through your mind and your research, especially as it relates to American history and how we have come to where we are today. And maybe what would be your 30,000-foot view, looking down on America today and what we face in this election cycle. We've never seen this before. We're in a different spot. What's Lord Black's take on it?
Yeah. By the way, this is a minor point, believe me, but you occasionally, I think, left viewers with the impression I'm no longer a member of the House of Lords.
Oh.
But I am, in fact, a member of the House of Lords. But
okay. Thank you.
It doesn't matter. I just for the sake of accuracy.
Thank you.
It's a distinguished House of Parliament, and I'm proud to be a member of it. But I think this, as you know, it's terribly complicated, and I don't want to be flippant. But I think we got a confluence of several things. After the great and, in fact, unprecedented strategic victory of the West in the Cold War, led by the United States, a bloodless victory in which our opponents simply fell like a souffle, disintegrated the Soviet Union, soon followed not a spirit of triumphalism, but to the great credit of the American people and others, there was just a sense of relief. But then, without a foreign challenger of the same gravity, we got into this pattern in the West of excessive self-criticism. It started commendably enough as, you know, let's not be too complacent, let's not be too pleased with ourselves. But it opened the door for a period of aberrant and in some respects, psychotic self-hate. And some of that is, for the very first time in American history, very audible now, with apparently plausible people saying the American Revolution was just a fraud perpetrated by a slaveholding economic interest, which is just utter rubbish. I mean, Benjamin Franklin was the head of the Abolitionist Society. The Adams, John Adams and his family, the first vice president, they were abolitionists. It was absolutely nothing of the kind. But I think it's a phase that, like people, sometimes become terribly self-critical and need their friends to buck them up a bit, or just to get through it and recognize that they're not perfect, but they have more worth than they may have thought. I mean, worth in the sense of character. Not talking about money here. And tied in with that was this Trump phenomenon where a man recognized, and almost nobody else did, that about half the population was quite discontented. Their disposable income had not moved in half a generation, and they felt the country was being governed for the benefit of others and not them. And he pitched to that, and they identified with it. And it has horrified the establishment which he attacked. And now, with that said, it is not the case, and I've thought about this very carefully, not the case at all, that the United States today resembles the late Roman Republic, which was ultimately, it wasn't exactly overthrown by Caesar, but it was replaced by his grandnephew, Octavian Caesar, the Emperor Augustus, and it does not resemble the late Roman Empire at all, not at all. It is not a degenerate country. It has a very creative workforce. The American people work hard. Most Americans are patriotic and believe in their country, even if they're dissatisfied with its present condition. You're not relying on foreigners to defend the country as the late Roman Empire was. And you do have institutions that work. Now, they're being tested, and the Constitution's being tested. And it's being tested by the indictment of the leader of the opposition on spurious grounds and this attempt to use the intelligence agencies and the Justice Department and the federal police, the FBI, to enter into partisan political matters. That's got to be stopped, and I think it will be. So it's a time of testing. I think not as severe a test as the Civil War, and not a greater test than the Great Depression, but on that scale. But the United States is not a decadent country at all. And I think it's plateaued, but it's not in decline, or certainly not necessarily in decline. I still have faith in it.
Thank you for saying that, because one of my concerns, and I think you described it as self-hate, there was a time, maybe even most recently, where we felt that the safe hate was terminal. But now I think we're seeing a revival and a pushback. No, we're Americans. We're about liberty and freedom. Hopefully that's true.
It's a great country.
Thank you. What about Canada? How do you see Canada these days?
It's big, but it's a great country.
Good.
So, look, in Canada, we're having an outburst of faddishness, but we have an excellent court system. Frankly, we have a better justice system than you do. We don't have a 98% conviction rate in federal criminal courts, you know, and defendants have a chance in Canada, which they don't really in the U.S. But each excess of the federal government is eventually struck down by the courts. And the people, as in all democracies, the people decide. Ultimately, the people are the judge. And I think we will have a change of government next year.
One last question, and thank you for your time. Volume 2 and 3, what's ahead? What are you looking at?
You mean for me, personally?
Well, in writing Volume 2 and 3.
Volume 2, I'm three-quarters of the way through it. It'll be out later this year. It'll bring us up almost to the American Revolution. And then the third volume will bring us all the way up to now. That'll be of 2 or 3 years, probably. I do other things, as you kindly mentioned. So
I have no idea when you sleep. Thank you, my friend, for your time. I look forward to more visits. A fascinating read. Let me tell our viewers and listeners, check it out. It's called The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. Again, there's a picture of the cover on the screen. Look for Volume 2 coming out, and hopefully Volume 3 down the road as well. And we welcome Lord Conrad Black anytime. Thank you, my friend. God bless you. Stay in the fight.
Thank you, Barry. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this week's Focus Today podcast. Remember, you can visit our website to check out all the interviews we did this week on our daily Focus Today TV show at thedove.us. And if you like this podcast, please take a moment to rate us and share it with your friends.